Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Marigold Clothing, making fashion fun since 1989. In Broad Ripple, featuring women's clothing, gifts, and accessories, and committed to customer service. More on Facebook or at marigoldclothing.com. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by eatdrinkindy.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink Indy. Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we have a very eclectic lineup. First, we'll be talking with some of our top chefs and restaurateurs, ones who have just recently been named as semifinalists in the James Beard Awards. We'll look back on interviews with Greg Hardesty of Recess, Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, Abby Maris of Bluebeard, Alan Sternberg of Cerulean, and Martha Hoover of Patashoo. Then we'll talk with two local filmmakers who are working on a film about the changing fishing industry. Kelly and J.D. Schuyler will tell us about their documentary, Last Man Fishing. And we'll also hear about a new distillery and restaurant opening in Indianapolis called Broken Beaker, as General Manager Craig Rogers tells us about the soon-to-open science-themed concept. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. Well, this is awards season, and that extends to the food business, too. The names of semifinalists for the James Beard Awards, which are often referred to as the Oscars of the food world, were released this past week, and as a voting member of the James Beard Foundation, I can't help but be excited. I look forward to the announcement of the semifinalists, often called the long list, as there are 20 people listed in each category, and I always hope that we have a good showing in the various categories from the Indianapolis area. This year, we have three Indianapolis chefs on the semifinalist list for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region: Greg Hardesty of Recess, Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, and Abby Maris of Bluebeard. Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean Restaurant, is a semifinalist for the national category of Rising Star Chef of the Year, which honors talented and promising young chefs age 30 and younger. And Martha Hoover of Cafe Patashoo, Petite Choux, Napoli's, and Public Greens made the semifinalist list for Outstanding Restaurateur, another national category. The list of final nominees, the short list, will be announced next month after the first round of voting from judges across the country, and then the awards gala will be May 2nd in Chicago. I'll be attending the awards, and who knows, maybe this is the year that one of our local chefs makes the short list. I'll be talking with these chefs and restaurateurs more as we get closer to the actual Beard Awards, but this week we look back at interviews with all of our 2016 James Beard semifinalists. We start with Greg Hardesty, chef owner at Recess and now a 5-time Beard semifinalist, who talks about his experience coming up through restaurant kitchens and changes he's seen in the business.
I graduated from IU in 1991 and tried to sell vinyl siding for Sears. And that didn't work so well. Then I got licensed to sell health insurance, and I got stuck in a snowstorm at a farmer's house, and I had this big old Mercury Grand Marquis, and I got stuck in this snowstorm, and I just lost my mind, and I threw it in reverse and hit the thing, and I plowed out of there somehow, and I said, I'm going to go do what I want to do. And so I got a job at the Glass Chimney in 1992. It was February. It was like 2 weeks before Valentine's Day. And I got hired because I went to IU, and there was two chefs there, Tony Huelster and Dan Savka. And Tony was an IU fan, and I had graduated from Indiana University. And he said, well, we need another IU fan around here, so he hired me. That was the only credential that got me the job. So so you know, that was kind of where I started. And
yeah, had you worked in restaurants before that, in college or something?
My first job was at McDonald's in Los Angeles, actually. My mom moved out there when I was a freshman in high school, and so I would go out there and spend the summers with her, and I was put on Big Macs, and I couldn't handle it. There was so many steps to a Big Mac. You can't believe how many steps there are to a Big Mac. And then they moved me over to Quarter Pounders. Couldn't do that. Then they moved me to the this is not an embellishment. Then I tried the Filet-O-Fish, and they finally just put me on the cash register, and so that was my first job. And then I worked at Crazy Horse when I was a senior at IU. It's so funny that I became a chef after I think I'm a chef. When I grow up, I want to be a chef. I couldn't handle the Big Mac station. It was like five steps, and it was just like you can't believe how, because this is before it was all mechanized. So.
Oh yeah, I remember the little jingle, all the things that go on, you know, two all beef patties, et cetera, et cetera.
Two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions, spicy bun.
That's it.
I loved food as a kid, and every memory I have is food related, and I can remember my first cheeseburger, or the first tomato on a burger that I loved. I can remember my first Reuben. I can remember the first time I had crab legs, and my mom made them for me, and on and on and on. So I always loved food, and so I started cooking for my roommates with that hand-hammered wok. I'd come home and probably might have had a drink or two in my sophomore year at IU, and I found that giving my friends food just made me, it created something that was like, okay, I like this feeling. And so that's sort of what I, after I got in that snowstorm, I'm like, I'm going to go do what I want to do. So I called my dad and said, hey, I'm going to be a chef. Thanks for the 4 years of degree. I just got a job for $6 an hour making salads. So that's how it started.
So you're making salads at the glass chimney.
Yeah.
How was that? What was that kitchen like? Was it a very old school?
Yeah, very old school. And I feel like one of the luckiest, I feel like I was part of the last of a generation who got to see old classical continental cuisine, table side stuff, and just the way stuff was, I think young chefs nowadays, they kind of riff on stuff, but they don't even know what they're riffing. I'm riffing on stuff that I actually saw, Chateaubriand and Tournedos and all those old classic recipes. It was the same menu for 30 years, and Dieter Puska was a great, great chef and a great mentor. I didn't even know it at the time, but he was. Now I should probably call it you make your own luck, I guess, but it felt like everywhere I went, it just sort of fell into place. This is what I was supposed to be doing, and it worked out for me, and I was able to sort of grow in my own career and learn from people that knew what they were doing, and I just sort of shut my mouth and kept my head down and said yes, sir, and it was a brutal five and a half years. I mean, I've been punched before in the chest, so.
Oh, wait, now talk a little bit about the the atmosphere, the sort of old school atmosphere that was probably prevalent in kitchens at the time.
Yeah, I think it's the beauty of the glass chimney experience was I had worked for a European already, so, and they definitely have the sort of brigade system where you don't talk back, you just say yes, sir. In fact, it was Joachim, I couldn't say yes, sir, or I couldn't say yes, chef. It had to be yes, sir. And if you said, yes, chef, he would say, there's a million chefs, but there's only one of me, in this little German accent. And working for Dieter, he was a hard guy to work for. It was never good enough. It was par for the course because I played baseball and basketball growing up all my life and played in high school. And, I was used to having coaches yell at me. That was just part of the norm. And being a slow white kid, I got yelled at a lot. I didn't move my feet very well, and I used to get burnt baseline a lot. So I was used to sort of getting my name called in a negative way. So the kitchen just became sort of my new sport. It was like it's competitive, it's physical, there's teamwork, there's a leader. So for me, it's being a chef has always been sort of my new athletic adventure.
That was Greg Hardesty, chef owner at Recess, and now a 5-time James Beard Award semifinalist. One of his former chefs, Jonathan Brooks, has had an incredible first year in business. After opening Milktooth in October 2014, not long before his 30th birthday, he has gotten plenty of national attention. He was among Food & Wine magazine's Best New Chefs of 2015, and his restaurant was among Bon Appetit magazine's Hot 10 Restaurants of this past year, and he was featured on a Food Network program as well. And now he is among James Beard's semifinalists for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region. I talked with John about all the accolades of the past year and about what all that attention was like.
Tell me how you would describe the kind of food that you make.
Well, in Milktooth, we make breakfast and lunch food.
Right.
First and foremost. But I think there's a lot of room within that to kind of have fun and take, you know, fine dining influences, world influences, personal influences, and force people to eat it for breakfast.
So the other day, there was crispy beef tongue on the menu. I noticed an Instagram photo the other day that sent me to looking up a word. So fatunta, was that right? It was like, and when I looked it up, it said the best garlic bread you'll ever have.
Yeah,
so
basically,
is that something like it?
Garlic toast. It's toast. It has a connection to breakfast, so we can throw some beef tongue on there, and it makes sense to me. And people ordered the hell out of it.
Did they really?
Oh, yeah. We sold out in about an hour and a half. I didn't have too many to start with. So
now I see a lot of those things where you say, you know, only X amount of something available. Do people come in and say, I saw that on Instagram this morning and they want that?
Oh, absolutely. I have one guy that he'll see an Instagram in the morning. He'll rush all the way downtown from up north. And occasionally he's been too late, but for the most part, he's in time and very excited.
Yeah. Well, so I think people are excited about the restaurant, and I think that's been sort of a part of the story arc. People got excited very early, including national media. So tell me a little bit about all of that and the attention that you've gotten from Food & Wine magazine, Bon Appetit, the Food Network.
Yeah, so about 6 months after we opened, or maybe less than 6 months after we opened, I got a wild phone call one afternoon from Food & Wine telling me that I had won 2015 Best New Chefs with 10 other people. And that was certainly, I don't even know how they were aware of us. It was certainly a surprise. Shocking.
Didn't think
it was real.
I was going to say, did you think that the phone call was real?
I mean, there was a brief moment when I thought somebody was just messing with me. And that it would be a really good joke. But, yeah, it was real.
What did you do? What was your reaction?
Well, they immediately told me that I couldn't tell anyone.
Oh, no!
Which, of course, I told my wife.
Well, yeah.
So I have to. And I think she might have told a few family members.
So what was it like?
But I don't know. It was so kind of out of left field. I mean, you know, we didn't open the restaurant to win awards or chase awards. You know, I'm familiar with Food & Wine, but I haven't had a subscription of Food Magazine in years, and it was definitely not something I was thinking about. But it's great. It's great. Been a great honor. Just met so many cool people.
Well, now you got to do some cool things in connection with that. So tell me about that. So you were...
Yes, so we got to go out to the Aspen Food & Wine Festival.
Wow.
Which
something
was
I've always wanted to do, I got to say.
Super fun. Got to take Ashley out there. You know, the group of chefs that I'm with this year, you know, not having had the experience before, but I couldn't have asked for a better group of new friends and people that are inspiring. So
now then you were also tapped for Bon Appetit's Hot 10 Restaurants of the Year.
Yep.
Across the country. So
right.
among the top 10
restaurants.
Yeah,
we were number 10, so we were worst of the best. We just slid in there.
But, you know, you're...
But we're in there, so we'll take it.
Yeah, so now how was that? Was that pretty exciting too?
That was, I mean... I couldn't say more exciting or less exciting, but it was different because it was a restaurant award. There was less focus on me, which may be more comfortable for me and I think more fun for the staff.
No, but that involved a trip to New York, right?
Yeah, yeah. We got to go out to New York and cook at Bon Appetit's big party. It's a great time. Got to take about 8 people off of my staff out there.
Oh, my gosh. How cool is that?
My wife and my sister. That's one of the proudest moments, one of the most fun moments we've had in the year that we've had the restaurant, just getting to take people from Indy out to a big fancy party in New York and have a good time.
Oh, my gosh. Now, okay, then you were also in New York in August cooking at the Beard House with a group of chefs from Indianapolis. Now, how was that?
That was really special, too. I know a few of the guys had cooked there before, but for a whole dinner to be based around Indiana chefs was humbling to be part of and just super cool.
How was it cooking in the Beard House with its notoriously small kitchen?
And we're notoriously big guys, the group that went out there. So
it's true.
It was tight, but, you know, everybody was so excited and calm and focused to be there that it was a great time.
That was Jonathan Brooks of Milk Tooth, who is a semifinalist for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region in the James Beard Awards. Also on the semifinalist list for Best Chef Great Lakes is Abby Maris, chef partner at Bluebeard. That restaurant got plenty of attention when it opened 3 years ago, and it made the semifinalist list that year for Best New Restaurant. Abby, who's also a former chef at Recess, explains how she got started in the business.
When I was 18, I moved to Norfolk, Virginia, and I got a job just at this little carry-out restaurant, and I was just a counter girl. But anyone that worked there has to do a little prep in the kitchen on their downtime. So eventually, just by doing that, I worked my way up and became the manager. And then I was like, oh, I think I'm actually pretty good at this. So I decided I was going to go to another restaurant and kind of just start building up, you know.
In the kitchen?
In the kitchen, yeah. So then I worked at another place in Norfolk. And then I figured it was time for me to move back to Indianapolis. So in 2005, I moved here. And I wasn't going to continue on with cooking anymore.
Well, what were you going
to
do?
I thought I would try to make more money and become a server. But Greg Hardesty was bound and determined to not let me do that. And so he gave me a job or made a position for me in his kitchen at Elements. So I was at Elements for 3 years. Went to the Chef's Academy for pastries with the scholarship, and then went out to New York for an internship for a few months.
Now tell me about that internship.
The internship was amazing. So it was 3 months long. I stayed in Manhattan. I worked at a place called Pong, which is now closed, Pacheong. Great sweet and savory pastry chef. And then I also had another job at this modern Italian restaurant called Falai, which was, again, owned by a pastry chef. But it was, a lot of, like, molecular gastronomy and, you know, chemicals and whatnot. So that was a really great experience. You know, I was just busy all the time working. I mean, if you live in New York, I feel like that's all you should probably be doing because it's way too expensive to do anything else.
Was that cool? So you weren't very old then, right? And so there you are in New York.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, I like to travel and, you know, being by myself is not hard when you're surrounded by, you know, millions of other people and like-minded people too in the restaurant industry.
Right.
Yeah, it was a blast. I learned a lot and learned a lot about myself, too, in that short amount of time.
That was Elements Culinary School internship. Then what?
And then I came back, and I worked briefly with Regina at our bistro. And then I also did a short stint at the Chef's Academy, being an assistant instructor. And then I went to Recess when Greg was opening that. So I was at Recess for about 2.5 years. And during that time, towards the end of it, Ed Batista approached John Adams and myself about, you know, doing this restaurant.
Now, what was that like to think about your own place?
It was very exciting, but also very, I was very nervous about it. Because, you know, I've always been a sous chef or, you know, a line cook for so long. And then this restaurant just kind of fell into our lap. And, we were pretty gung-ho, but I was very nervous. But once it all started happening, it seemed very natural. And now here we are, 3 years later. It's been pretty successful.
Well, now, talk a little bit about what happened along the way, because you guys came out with a bang and got lots of national attention right away. What was that like?
It was very surprising. We were not expecting that to happen. But, from the very beginning, you know, as soon as the doors opened up, people were flooding in, and we were not prepared for it. The kitchen was not designed properly. Like, we had to get more equipment. We had to hire more people. And it was hilarious because even with the Culture Trail being dug up, you know, parking was a huge issue. People were just, like, crawling over, like, piles of dirt. It was bizarre.
It was. I mean, really, it was torn up in front of the restaurant. They were, you know, like plywood to try to step over the stuff. And yet people kept coming.
Yeah. Yep. And now it's finally beautiful and fixed, and they still keep coming, thank God.
Now, what were you going for when you created this? Because, you know, you were involved from the very start, you know, as you said, you know, from the very thought that, well, maybe you're going to have a restaurant.
Well, the initial idea was to have, an ever-changing menu, showcasing a lot of bread, obviously, because Amelia's our bakery, but also staying true to, like, true Italian food. Being that we're in an Italian neighborhood, the Battistas are Italian, the bread's Italian. But then that simply faded because I was like, I want to do a burger today. You know, I kind of want to eat tacos. I want to eat pho. So that kind of got away from us. And then now we're just, contemporary American. And I think it's fine. Yeah. You know, the food's great. We still have pastas.
Have you seen some changes as you've gone along with customers? You know, do you feel like, you know, maybe are they more adventuresome now than they were, you know, some years ago?
Oh, yes, for sure. I think with the popularity of the chef stardom has and the television, you know, there's so many TV shows that promote the culinary scene. And I think people are definitely more ambitious, and there's many places that you can be ambitious at now in Indy. Before, I don't think there was that many places. We're not just a steakhouse city anymore.
Talk a little bit about the culinary scene, you know, that as you've seen it evolve over the last few years.
Well, I guess when I arrived in the city in 2005, you know, there was a handful of places that whenever I was off, you know, I could attend or go and eat some of the food, but nothing really like stuck out in my mind. But now, you know, you look down Virginia Avenue and there's, you know, Pioneer, there's Milk Tooth, even the old bars around here, like the Dugout, they're like rehabbing their entire menu and trying to like be with the times now. So yeah, I mean, it's blossomed tremendously.
We've been talking with Abby Maris, chef partner at Bluebeard, and a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best Chef in the Great Lakes region. Another local chef found himself a Beard semifinalist this week as well, but Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean Restaurant, showed up in a different category. He is a semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year, a national category that honors talented and promising young chefs aged 30 and younger. Alan, who's 29, talks about the importance of local food and about his own food philosophy.
Culture and food are both synonymous and independent of each other. Because, you know, if you're just eating fries and chicken nuggets and whatever, that, there's no culture there, but that's still food. You know, it will sustain you. But when you have a place where the people really care, when you have, you know, a diner that might not serve the best food in the world, but, you know, the family that runs it pours their soul into it. You know, we're an ethnic family that's come here to make a better life, and they, you know, they cook food the best that they can cook it in the way that they were taught by their parents or grandparents or whatever, and trying to be authentic. There's a sense of culture. There's a sense of soul. I think soul leads to some culture. I think that when you have a group of passionate people about something similar, that's where you find the birth of some kind of cultural event.
What is it about food and restaurants and little neighborhood places like the Legend that we were just at? What is it about those kind of places that's important for a neighborhood?
You know, I think a lot of the bigger issues with communities is, or neighborhoods, is when people aren't invested, when they don't have, you know, the landmarks that they take their family to, where they don't have, you know, a sense of ownership about anything, and, you know, you're trying to get away from it. That's really where a lot of the issues start. So, you know, restaurants work really well for that, because anybody can come into them. Anybody can go out to eat, you know, with place like the Legend. It's affordable, you know, it's not priced out of the neighborhood, so it's very much a working class type of establishment where you can go get some good food. It doesn't have to be life-changing, but I mean, it's good, you know, it tastes good. People feel welcomed when they're there. People obviously had a good time. I mean, the room was a buzz the whole time we were in there, and people just like going there. You ask why they're important, and, you know, it's a place that's hospitable. It's a place where you go and you can kind of let go of, you know, the things that are happening in your life, and someone takes care of you. You know, you don't have to cook for yourself. You don't have to go get yourself a drink. It's very core to who we are in Indiana. All those little neighborhood places, the reason they become neighborhood places and the reason they really kind of get their core demographic and their core customers is because they gain rapport. They come there for the hospitality. They come there for food. They come there for all these reasons, and they build that rapport with a server or an owner or a cook or somebody. And it just feels more like family. You know, you see the same people there every Sunday, and, you know, you get to know the people that are sitting across from you. And you start friendships that way. You know, it's a place where a community can come together.
Well, no. So a while back we went to the farmer's market too in Irvington, which is kind of a different farmer's market. You know, it has a different vibe about it than, you know, say, oh, the Carmel or the Broderville farmer's market. So that's a community building thing too, don't you think?
Yeah. I mean, that was the thing that I really saw, and was that people were there for having fun. There's people that were there to promote just Irvington and really kind of, you know, lay claim and say, this is ours. We're proud of this. You know, you should be proud of this too if you live here. And they're trying to build everybody around an idea. You know, they're not trying to, oh, well, we'll dump $2 million into this, you know, community center, and then we'll just, you know, wipe our hands clean and move on to the next place, and everybody will love it and it'll help the neighborhood. Like, that's not what's happening here. It's, you know, there's a row of restaurants right here, and, you know, the median's well manicured, and there's again a sense of pride in it. You know, people are putting money in it, people are putting their time into it, people are putting effort into it, and it's one of the reasons that this is one of the coolest neighborhoods in the city to me, is because it is very independent. You know, it's not, it has its identity. It has, oh, you're from Irvington, cool. You know, Black Acres over here, there's a handful of restaurants, there's little things that are happening that are people fighting the good fight, and people around here saying, you know what, I like it. You know, I don't have to leave for everything. You know, that's very much where a lot of the neighborhoods are, I think, is you go there and there's nothing there. You know, there's no good restaurants. I'm not saying expensive or independent. Well, they're probably going to be independent, but there's no good restaurants. It's chains or it's nothing. It's the same chicken tenders and French fries. It's, you know, there's no heart and soul there. But I think you get a restaurant where even if you're not producing the best food in the world, but you kind of have that sensibility, that community, that feel about you. Like, people can see that, you know, you're not just trying to give them whatever. You're going to care about it. You're going to care about the food, and you're going to do the best you can. You're going to care about the guests and give them the best experience that you can give them. You know, you're going to build a rapport. You're going to build a community.
That was Alan Sternberg, executive chef at Cerulean Restaurant and a James Beard Award semifinalist for Rising Star Chef of the Year. Indianapolis also has a semifinalist in the Outstanding Restaurateur category. Martha Hoover, well known for her Pâte à Choux empire, which also includes Petite Choux Bistro, three locations of her Napolese artisan pizzerias, and her latest restaurant, Public Greens, an urban kitchen with a mission. The profits from that restaurant go to Hoover's Pâte à Choux Foundation, which feeds food insecure kids after school. Martha tells us about her efforts to build a radically different company.
My goal is to really build a restaurant company that is radically different and radically better. Our company happens to be in the restaurant business, but my theory is that we could be doing anything using the principles that we use in the company. We could be selling any consumer product. We could be selling any service. We could be in any variety. We could be in healthcare, we could do whatever, and still stick to the principles that we use as our guiding principles. And it really, these principles really have separated us out from the pack. We have a vision of greatness, and I don't mean a vision of grandeur, because it's the difference between confidence and ego. But we're very proud of what we've worked on since 1989. You know, we created a restaurant, I created a restaurant in 1989, before terms like farm-to-table were in the common lexicon, right?
Oh, sure. We didn't talk about that then.
No, and thankfully we didn't, because I find now that there's not a lot of transparency in it, and, you know, when people like McDonald's and Walmart are talking about their farmer relationships, you just go, what does farm-to-table mean anymore? And in all honesty, every restaurant is, in a sense, a farm-to-table restaurant. But it's the kind of farms that you use and the kind of relationships that you have with your farmers, and the quality of the ingredients that you're using and what you do with the ingredients where you get them in that really distinguishes all restaurants, right? There were some key areas that were really important to me. Most businesses, of course, are most interested in their bottom line, in profits. And I am a proud but enlightened capitalist. I believe that obviously for us to be enduring, we have to be profitable.
Sure.
But the real question is, what do you do with the profits that your business makes? How do you treat your vendors? How do you treat your staff? How do you treat your customers? And how do you treat your community?
Right.
And all of those items have become bottom lines for us. So we just don't adhere to a strict business model where we look at profit loss, we look at the profit, we stick it in the bank, we stick it in the owner's pockets, and we say, oh, we've done a great job. We actually look further. So one of our areas where we really believe that we are radically different and radically better is in our continuous attempt to source the finest ingredients possible. You know, in 1989, when we were sourcing these ingredients, the food world was much different. There was no goal to be historic in anything. I was just doing something that I felt was really important. But there was no larger vision. It was just, I couldn't go to a restaurant where the food met my standards. I didn't want to take my children to the restaurant. Okay. And I needed something in my own neighborhood, and I thought that there would probably be other like-minded people who wanted to eat healthier.
Sure.
And that's all it was. But luckily, spending years driving around the countryside, going to farmers and all that kind of stuff, buying my own provisions, allowed me the relationships, you know, so when I opened up my first restaurant, I had some really serious relationships that were really friendly relationships, and I was able to buy someone's corn, and I was able to buy someone's eggs, and my thinking was just that they tasted better. They were higher quality, and they tasted better. You know, yes, they were seasonal. Yes, they were local. In many instances, they were natural. So I really loved all that. But there was no farm-to-table philosophy. And that's one of the most amazing changes to me. It's not just the explosion of restaurants and restaurateurs. It's also the public's awareness and their expectations has changed dramatically, which I think is really wonderful.
We've been talking with restaurateur Martha Hoover of Patashew Inc., who is a 2-time semifinalist for the National James Beard Awards category of Outstanding Restaurateur. We'll be following along as the James Beard Foundation releases its short list of final nominees March 15th. Go to eatdrinkindy.com for more info. Food encompasses all sorts of things. There's the chef perspective that we've been talking about already today here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio. But there are also a lot of other aspects of local food that people here in the city and in central Indiana are working on. People like Kelly and J.D. Schuyler, who are local filmmakers working to tell the stories of people involved in local food. But local food doesn't necessarily just mean here in the Midwest. Kelly and J.D. are currently at work on a documentary called Last Man Fishing, which is exploring the current situation of small family fisheries across the United States. And they're finding out that, like the small family farm that we're familiar with here, small family fishing operations are facing considerable challenges today. I caught up with Kelly and J.D. this past week to find out what drew these Midwesterners to travel across the country to create their documentary.
Last Man Fishing is a feature-length documentary that is 1 year into production. We have 1 year left, and it's all about the struggles of the small-scale commercial fishermen.
Now, that's not a very Midwestern sort of thing. So tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got into this.
Yeah, well, it wasn't a natural fit in the beginning, but, you know, I have a history with local food, and that led me to a company called Sitka Salmon Shares in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And they source the Midwest, and they focus on small-scale fishing and sustainable fish. And we made those connections, and they really opened this world to small-scale fishermen all across the coast and their struggles. And that was the motivation to do this documentary and get the word out about some of their concerns and issues.
Now, people might be familiar with the Sitka Salmon Shares. You know, it's like a CSA for fish, you know, that people can sign up for it, and it gets delivered right to them from family fisher people in Alaska, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so that company specifically is focused on sustainability, a fair price, and just taking care and changing the seafood industry. And so through working with them, I think we learned a lot about the seafood industry, and that really, you know, motivated us to get to work.
Now, Kelly, tell me about your role and how you became involved in this, too. You've looked at farming, right, in the past and trying to, and telling the story of family farms, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I've done a lot of photography with family farms around the world and saw a lot of parallels between family farms and the small-scale fishermen and the fisheries and the coastal towns. So that was part of the interest with getting involved. And then I'm married to JD, so I kind of tagged along, and now I'm doing some audio and behind-the-scenes photography and learning filmmaking.
Now, how has it been going from smaller projects to a feature-length documentary? Challenging?
Yeah, there's a huge learning curve, but I think, you know, we're both really driven and focused. So as we're learning, we're just moving along, and we're learning as we go. And so it's been difficult, but we're excited about getting this together and getting it out.
Now, tell me a little bit about the process. How did you start, and sort of where it went from there?
Yeah, well, once we decided we were going to start the documentary, we really started to do our research. You know, you really need to find those characters, find the issues that exemplify what you're trying to communicate. So that was a process in itself, but once we started to make those connections, it was just booking flights and getting out to the, you know, the East and West Coast, getting to Alaska, meeting these people firsthand. And then once you hear their story, you realize, you know, they love their jobs, and they've really been welcoming and just great to work with.
Now, how has it been, you know, trying to find common ground and understanding their struggle that they face, you know, as a person coming from the Midwest?
Yeah, that's one thing I asked them was, you know, the story is hopefully going to be nationally told. How do we communicate this? And they said, well, you know, you guys are from the Midwest. You know the story, the family farm. You know, over the last few decades, you know, is the family farm still here? And it's changed dramatically. And so they said, this is what's happening to the small-scale fishermen. So there's a lot of parallels between those industries. And I think it's just now it's the small-scale fishermen that's making those adjustments and facing those issues.
So what are you finding out about the family fisheries and the struggles that they're facing?
One thing, geographically, so we're everywhere, and there's a lot of different policies that influence different coasts. And so the thing that really probably ties everybody together that we're following is just they're up against a lot. And so I think that's the story that we're really trying to weave together, is that whether they're on the East Coast or the West Coast, small-scale fishing is being challenged policy-wise and even environmentally. And these are the guys that can really be the best stewards of the ocean.
Now, some of the footage that I've seen, you know, you're obviously, you know, shooting in committee meetings and hearings and that sort of thing. How has that been?
Yeah, really long and boring at times, but it's also really educational. You realize that, you know, policy and political things aren't easy to deal with and wrestle with, but through those, you know, you meet a lot of people and you really begin to understand how these policies are formed, who are the players, who's really, you know, getting their lobbyist in there. That's always an interesting thing, is who has the most lobbyists and who has the biggest political sway, I guess. So it's a learning opportunity for sure.
You know, we've seen that here in Indiana with, you know, the farmers. Do the stories come out in those kinds of, you know, scenarios, you know, in the legislative hearing rooms and that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, every region is managed by a fisheries management council, and they're very specific about having public testimony opportunities. So that's really when you hear the fishermen coming out. They'll organize. They have their advocacy groups. They'll get out and they'll get their stories. And that's great for us, too, because that's when we get to meet some of the people that are really being challenged and faced with a lot of issues.
How do you go about, you know, from the, you know, the, you know, legislative hearings to the beautiful scenery on the boats to the talking to people individually? How do you go about weaving the stories all together? Because, I mean, it could go on for hours, I'm sure. And you have to weave it together and edit it down. How do you go about starting to do that?
Yeah, it takes a lot of time in the editing room, a lot of thought, and I think it's just about a balance, really. It's going to be a lot of work, but I think what we're trying to do is balance those policy issues with the livelihood of these fishermen, with some of that beautiful scenery that you mentioned, and I think through those, weaving those together in a balance that you know, audience members can get the story, understand it, and hopefully be motivated to get engaged and see the fisheries differently.
What's the time frame on a project of this scope?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, documentaries can span forever, and I think this is actually probably a shorter one than most feature-length films can be. You know, we've shot for a full year now. We're going to shoot this coming year and then hopefully just focus on editing. You know, I think I've read a number of times that 3 years is probably the average for a feature-length documentary.
So the hope is that this will come out when?
Yeah, early 2017 is our date.
Where is there a venue that you have in mind? Is there a film festival, or can we expect to maybe see it at something like that?
Yeah, we're definitely going to hit the film festival circuit as hard as we can. I mean, this is a national story. You know, nationally, we all eat seafood. And we all participate in the industry. So we're hoping to get it out to as many film festivals as possible.
It seems like a fit for things like that. Now tell me, you are raising money to help fund the next leg of this filming, right?
Yeah, we have a Kickstarter campaign going right now for $35,000. And that will help fund editing and this year of travel to the East and West and the Gulf Coast.
Now, can people sort of follow along with your adventure? Are you, you know, keeping people updated about this?
We are. We have an Instagram account. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Last Man Fishing is the handle for all of those. And then we have a website, lastmanfishing.com. And we're always updating, love to share where we are and what we're up to.
We've been talking with Kelly and J.D. Schuyler about their documentary, Last Man Fishing. For more information about the documentary and their Kickstarter campaign to continue to fund their work, you can find them on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Last Man Fishing. Scene here in Indianapolis continues to grow. We're continuing to see not only more restaurants, but also more distilleries. And one that's set to open soon on Massachusetts Avenue definitely has an interesting angle. Broken Beaker Distillery, from the husband and wife team of chemist Thomas Wasaki and engineer Heather Finfrock, will have a definite science theme from the test tube-style glasses to the periodic table of elements-shaped back bar. Broken Beaker General Manager Craig Rogers fills us in about the unique distillery that's set to open next week.
First and foremost, we want to be a distillery that serves food. We want people to come in and try our spirits and then try the sandwiches that have a great flavor profile, the food that have a great, that has a great flavor profile. It is a chemistry-based. That comes from the owners who are... husband is a chemist and the wife is an engineer. So they kind of ran with the science theme because they just love science.
Now that science theme will continue through the whole place, right?
So it continues from the staff to the guest experience. So our glassware is science-based, beaker-based. We'll have test tube flights for people.
Yeah, now describe that a little bit. You know, when you say beaker-based.
So, like, our wine glasses have wine stems with flasks on the top of them that you would find in a laboratory. And then the coasters that we're having made have, and the bottles are going to have different scientific facts on them that people will have. And as far as the staff goes, we want our mixologists to be able to experiment. So if they want to create a vodka flavor report for us, then let's infuse it, see how it goes, get feedback on it, and then if it does really, really well, then we'll put it through the still and make it one of our staples.
So when you talk about a chemistry theme, as far as the looks, what will the looks of the distillery.
Right. So the back bar is in the shape of the periodic table. And then, you know, even on the menu, like the menu, our menus are going to be printed on graph paper. It's going to, our cocktail menu is separated into elements and molecules and things like that. Everything kind of has a science name. But as far as like the actual, that's kind of as far as it goes for us. Everything is just going to be a really calm environment that we want people to come in and have a good time.
So it's not going to necessarily look like a laboratory.
Correct. Yeah, it's not going to look like a laboratory.
So as far as the spirits go, what type of spirits can people expect to see?
So to start off, we will have a vodka, gin, and a rum. We'll have a lime cordial, a ginger liqueur. And then going off of that, we already have a lot of infusions already in mind. We're going to have an Indian spice gin to start off with. We'll have a vanilla bean vodka. We'll have a jalapeno vodka. So, and those are all going to be infusions to start.
So you'll be serving your own spirits, but you'll also have beer and wine?
So we'll have a rotating wine menu that will be easy to change based off of the season. And then we'll have four beers on draft.
And as far as the food goes, what can we expect there?
So we'll have different cheese boards, charcuterie boards. We'll have paninis. We'll have a couple different sides of chips, macaroni and cheese, soup, which is all going to be made, homemade. And then we will have a brunch menu on Sundays, which includes French toast paninis, oatmeal, yogurt, things like that. And then we do have a dessert menu, which will be available every day.
Now, how do you envision a distillery fitting in on Mass Ave?
I feel like it is really the one realm that we don't have here yet. So we are looking at being the first one on Mass Ave and just being a part of, you know, the bar industry and drink industry and food industry that's already very well established on the street.
And tell me a little bit about your background and perspective on the project.
So I'm very excited about the project. I was actually a music major in college, and then I stumbled into the industry and fell in love. I've worked at a couple different places on Mass Ave, and I've seen Mass Ave continuously grow in the past 5 or 6 years. And then I went down to Greenwood, and I was at Reverend Greenwood, where I was their GM for a little bit, and then I came back down here because... I feel like distilleries are the next thing in Indiana, and so I just wanted to be a part of one of the first ones, and I'm really excited about it.
Now tell me a little bit more about the owners.
So Thomas is a chemist, and Heather is an engineer. They first got into distilling in about 2010, when at that point in time you weren't allowed to have a tasting room. So they were looking for different warehouse spaces just to set up a still and to distribute. And then the laws changed, and then they started looking for what would be the best place to open a distillery with a tasting room.
Now, what sort of things are coming down the road? You mentioned some infusions, that sort of stuff?
So we'll have different infusions, and that's going to be all up to the bartenders and us as well, the upper management. And then coming down the road, there will be different whiskeys, different liqueurs, things like that. People will be able to buy and walk out the front door. And then we will also, in about a couple months, you'll hopefully find us in different restaurants because we'll start distribution as well.
Well, that was another question as to whether your spirits will be out available in other places.
Yeah, so we're looking at probably about 2 or 3 months at getting us ready, and then we will we'll definitely start distributing it within the first quarter.
And what's the opening target? Do we have a target date yet?
So we are going to be open to the public on February 25th. It's a Thursday, starting at 4 p.m. And we'll have a couple cocktail specials and things that are not on the cocktail menu that will be created by our mixologist, and that we'll run those specials for the weekend for sure.
And things coming up down the road?
So we're really excited about St. Patrick's Day, that we're going to be open in time for St. Patrick's Day. It's a big, big day down on Mass Ave, and we're actually, instead of opening at 4 like normal, we're open at 10 to be available for the parade, and then people are out all day long, and we're actually going to distill our own green, house-made green shot that people can come in. Going to call it leprechaun juice. We haven't quite figured out the flavor profile yet, but it's going to be one of those that's distilled in-house. It's specifically ours, and we'll be able to pour it straight from bottle to test tube for people to try.
We've been talking with Craig Rogers of Broken Beaker Distillery. For more information, go to brokenbeakerdistillery.com. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. Thank you so much for tuning into the show this week, and thanks also to our guests, chefs Greg Hardesty of Recess, Jonathan Brooks of Milktooth, Abby Maris of Bluebeard, Alan Sternberg of Cerulean, and restaurateur Martha Hoover of Patashu Inc. Thanks also to filmmakers Kelly and J.D. Schuyler of Last Man Fishing, and to Craig Rogers, general manager at Broken Beaker Distillery. And thanks also to producer John Ketzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.